Hello, hello, and hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode, If Not Now, When? In today's show, I am so honored and excited to meet my guest. We got Brett Benz in the show with us. Brett is a partner at ATX Venture Partners. He spent the first career, actually the first decades, as an archaeologist. Super smart. Traveled the whole world on a different research project. Then, after MBA, he started his second career at a private equity firm, transacting over $72 million in equity capitals, and then eventually as a partner of ATX Venture Partners. Today, he's so passionate about meeting entrepreneurs from different sectors to truly grow and scale their business and making a dent on this universe. So with that, everybody, I am so honored and grateful. Please join me to welcome Brett to the show. Brett, thank you. Welcome to the show.
Yeah.
Tell us all, how does all the magic begin for you?
How the magic began? That's a tough question. Well, my dad was actually an entrepreneur, a founder.
Oh, my goodness.
So I grew up in that kind of a household, mm-hmm. seeing my parents both very, you know, entrepreneurial.
What do they do? What kind of entrepreneur?
So my dad was a co-founder of a manufacturing company here in Texas, mm-hmm. back in the 60s and early 70s. Mm-hmm. And then my mom, you know, started her own business as a real estate broker doing commercial real estate investing. So had both parents that were very active business people. And
That's
yet I came out of high school not really wanting to follow in their footsteps.
Why is that?
I don't know, but it just didn't, at the time, it didn't really excite me. I was more interested in science. And so I, you know, went down that path to become an archaeologist. And
tell us more about that.
Went to college, obviously, and focused on anthropology. So archaeology is one of the subdisciplines, and got involved in field work, got to work on a lot of really interesting projects around the world.
How was that experience, by the way? Not many people have opportunity to be an archaeologist?
Archaeologist.
Archaeologist is a fancy word I learned today. Like travel the world and see all the ancient sites and study and research those beautiful artifacts. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah. So had a lot of varied experiences. So mm-hmm. some of them were, you know, focusing on historic archaeology, mm-hmm. some prehistoric. Some of it was in the context of trying to salvage mm-hmm. artifacts that were, you know, being threatened by a construction project. Some of them were strictly research focused. So, mm-hmm. You know, a variety of experiences, but they were all really positive. And
was it everything you wanted at the time, Brad?
It was. I mean, you know, the only thing that's really hard to do is to make a living at it. It's very challenging as an academic to get established. And then, you know, around that time I got married and my wife was coming here. She was an immigrant and she had a law degree, but it was from a country that wasn't recognized.
Which country?
She was coming from France.
Oh, okay.
She had a law degree from France, but her degree wasn't recognized in the U.S. So she would have to start law school all over again a second time. And so it was going to be very difficult for us financially for us to both be in graduate school. So I, you know, wanted to support her for her to get her law degree in the U.S. And so I taught myself to be a software developer.
Wow.
So that I could.
That's a huge jump.
It was, but it was kind of the shortest. I had already taken kind of a part-time job while I was a grad student doing a little bit of web development. Mm-hmm. So I was really just kind of formalizing what I had already been doing a little bit on the side.
And so it was easy for you.
It was the shortest path to be able to support someone and put them through school. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why I headed down that path. And after doing that for about 6 years, I, you know, came to a fork in the road where I could have gone back and finished my degree or gone in a different direction.
So how do you make a decision?
Well, it was tough, but, you know, as a practicing attorney, my wife has to be licensed in each state. Mm-hmm. And as an academic, you often have to move around. So you are teaching, you know, at a university in Montana 1 year, and then the next year you've got a teaching position in Florida for a couple of years, and then you have to move on. Eventually, you may land on a tenure-track position somewhere, but that can take 5 or 6 years. And if your spouse has to be licensed in each and every state and go through the bar exam,
it's
very, very hard to drag that person around the country. So it just didn't seem like a viable path, even though it was kind of my first love. And even though I could have kind of doubled down on software development and gotten a degree in computer science, let's say. I was really more interested in what the business imperatives were that were driving the projects I was working on. And so that led me to a business degree and eventually into entrepreneurship.
That's so exciting. But I'm curious, was it hard to say goodbye to the first love that you've been part of for a solid decade or so, your lifetime? Was it a hard decision?
It was, because I, you know, had gone 5 or 6 years into a PhD program and had to just put all that behind me. But, you know, you just have to move forward.
Yeah.
And so I still love archaeology and still, you know, read about it and follow it. But, you know, just realized it wasn't going to be a vocation for me. And that's okay. You know, I've moved on and done other things. And I feel it still was a very enriching period of my life.
That's beautiful. So tell us, after business school, you know, tell us about that entrepreneurship journey that you embarked after that.
Yeah. So, I was initially went to business school with the idea that I would go into product management at a tech company, kind of marrying the business skills and the technical skills and then being able to translate between those types of stakeholders. But I ended up getting recruited into finance. So my current business partner was the co-founder of a private equity firm in Austin called Virtus that's still around. It's a dedicated private equity real estate fund. And so he recruited me to join him on the investment team. And so we worked together there for a few years and really enjoyed the experience of working together. He ended up leaving Virtus and going and being an operator at several other companies. And I ended up going to IDC, which is a big IT market research company, and then Boston Consulting Group up in the Boston area. And then he launched ATX Seed Ventures, which was the precursor of what we are today as a firm. So after about a year in, he called me up and asked if I would be interested in partnering with him again and moving back to Austin. So that was kind of the first real jump into entrepreneurship for me, was to take that leap, move my family back here and, you know, work with him. And then we also recruited a third partner, Danielle, to join the firm. And that was when we kind of rebranded as ATX Venture Partners. We really wanted to professionalize and institutionalize the firm. And that's the journey we've been on for the last 7 or 8 years.
Wow, what a journey. So how was that jump for you?
Well, I mean, it was a little scary. I mean, the good thing was we weren't starting totally from scratch. So we already had a fund. We already had a number of investments that were already had already been made. And so I was, you know, joining an existing team, but then we needed to really revamp our processes and think about the scope of what we were doing so that we could be institutionally ready. We wanted to start being able to take institutional money as we rebranded and refocused the firm. So that was kind of what we did around 2015, 2016, when we launched our second fund. That was when we really made that transition and started to be able to onboard institutional investors into our capital base.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible. And for our listeners who might not as familiar with ATX Partners, would you mind tell us a little bit more about the fund, the venture?
Yeah, so we're an early stage venture capital firm here in Austin. Been around since 2014, but like I said, we kind of rebranded a year or two in so that we're not just seed focused. We also do Series A investing.
Nice.
But still definitely early stage. And, you know, we're still, we still consider ourselves a startup in a way because, you know, we didn't spin out of an established venture capital firm. So, you know, we had a much harder time raising money from institutions than somebody who was already, say, a partner at an established firm and then spins out and starts his or her own firm. They have that pedigree to point back to that we didn't have. But now that we've been in market for 8 years, you know, we have a much easier time because we have enough of a track record to to point to of our own.
So for entrepreneurs who might also in the process of raising, for him or her, maybe also their first time, right? Talk about your own, your journey. I know it's a little bit different, but fundamentally it's the same-ish. How was that like, you know, be part of the exciting and emerging firm and to get the first critical capitals?
Yeah. So you get the door slammed in your face a lot. So we had quite a few calls that didn't go as we would have liked. It was, you know, it was a process of just being very, very persistent.
But how do you even get start a process? How do you even get a call scheduled, for example, for a lot of entrepreneurs, maybe they are technical founders, they are scientists or engineers, they're like, okay, well, I don't even know where to get started.
Yeah. So, you know, we, you know, fortunately we're part of a team. It wasn't just me. So Chris and Danielle, and then we had several other people on the team that were helping to get those initial meetings. And then usually as part of the process, they want to talk to the entire GP team to get to know them, to get to know the partners, what their philosophy is, their approach to venture investing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, thankfully I was not, you know, directly responsible on the fundraising side. I was more working more with the founders. But I definitely got pulled into the process of raising capital because, like I said, you know, before someone's going to write you a seven-figure check, they want to meet everybody on the team.
Of course.
So,
yeah.
And it's just a matter of persistence. It took a long time to close that second fund.
Yeah. How long? A year or two?
About a year and a half or 2 years to fully close it. Which is why being persistent really pays off.
Wow.
But, you know, if you're a founder of an operating company, it's a little different because there's an opportunity cost to fundraising because you're not able to build your product. You're not able to serve your customers because you're focusing on trying to talk to investors. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it can be a hindrance to a founder of an operating company to spend 2 years fundraising. But really, you know, for most founders, it's episodic. They're focusing on fundraising for a few months at a time. Then they go back to, you know, actually executing and growing their company. And then they reach another inflection point and they have to go back and, mm-hmm. and raise another round of capital. Mm-hmm. Whereas for us, it was a little more of kind of a constant drip, drip, drip of, you know, onboarding new LPs and then, you know, getting to that final, you know, fundraising target. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's a bit of a pause and then we're launching the next fund.
Mm-hmm. Wow, what an exciting journey. And Brad, sounds like, you know, you are very familiar with entrepreneurs in their process of raising. I'm curious, what do you think about the raising for early stage entrepreneurs? Is there such a thing as too early? Is there such a thing as a distraction? How do you see that?
Well, it's absolutely necessary. I mean, you can't get anything accomplished if you don't have the resources on your balance sheet to go and, you know, meet payroll, do the R&D to develop your product, you know, maintain office space, all of those things that you absolutely need to do to serve your customers. Mm-hmm. So it's an absolutely necessary function, fundraising. It's just not what most people got into entrepreneurship for. So that's why it can be a distraction. And also most people who get into entrepreneurship don't necessarily have a large Rolodex of wealthy investors that they can immediately call.
Yeah.
Maybe if they're second or third time out, they've established those relationships. But as a first-time founder, often you don't know where to start. So
what would you say to her? Maybe they are exactly like you described. They are first time out. They don't have all the fancy network connections.
Yeah.
They did not get into entrepreneurship for this, right? So how do you tell them that? What is the next viable steps?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the kind of company that you're trying to create as a founder. Because, you know, I work in venture capital, but venture capital is just one source of funding among many for founders. And it's the right tool for a certain subset of companies that can scale rapidly, that are, you know, high profit, high growth.
Define high growth.
You know, I would say minimally we're talking companies that can grow their top line, you know, 2 or 3x per year in those early phases of the company's life. That's kind of the zone that VCs like to play in. And we're also looking at companies that have a very large addressable market.
Which is range?
You know, in the billions, let's say.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. And that, you know, plausibly have what it takes to become a dominant company in their respective category. So that's...
How do you define that? When you look at a company, how do you know whether he or she having a possibility to dominate?
That's one of the hard things about being an investor this early on is that you don't have a lot of data to go on. You know, a lot of it is about looking at the team. Does the team have the right skills? Are they addressing a real problem or is it a nice to have?
Champagne versus oxygen.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, how good is the solution that they've developed and what are their customers saying about it? So for us, as part of our diligence, we talk to customers of the company and understand what their problems are and how well the solution actually addresses that. mm-hmm. and whether this is a real problem or if it's more of a, mm-hmm. well, sometimes people will just like to evaluate new technologies. Doesn't mean that it's really a problem that they're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. And that's come up on some of our diligence calls occasionally is, mm-hmm. hey, we just heard about this. It sounds cool. We wanted to kick the tires and, you know, maybe there'll be a use case for it in our company. Maybe there won't. That's not the answer that an investor wants to hear. They want to hear that there's a hair on fire problem and we need an answer to this problem today.
Yeah.
And this product can actually help us. That's really the ideal answer that we're looking for when we're talking to mm-hmm. customers.
Mm-hmm. This must happen right now. Otherwise, I cannot live.
Exactly.
Completely. Here you said that oxygen versus champagne, that, you know, if I have enough money, I'll buy champagne versus, hey, if I don't have oxygen, I will die right now.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what you're looking for as an investor is, you know, entrepreneurs that have found customers that have a really urgent burning problem, because mm-hmm. that's going to spur rapid adoption. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's a nice to have, mm-hmm. then the adoption is likely to be slow mm-hmm. and painful.
Yeah. Yeah. Great points here. And, you know, with the founder that you are meeting every day and also our mm-hmm. team meeting every day, you know, in addition to that, like, what are you looking at? Like, do you want to make sure they have a great team? You mentioned about a problem. Like,
right.
is there any maybe matrix that he or she maybe on the other hand say, wow, I want to reach out to Brad. I wonder what would be a good checkbox I can mm-hmm. check today, so it will be yes for him.
Yeah, so a very large market that you can grow into.
Billions.
A compelling problem.
Okay.
And a solution that addresses that problem really mm-hmm. well.
Okay.
And then the team that can execute and actually grow the company quickly.
How do you define that?
So.
That's tough.
It's tough. But, you know, obviously if somebody has prior experience mm-hmm. with an earlier company that they've helped to scale and exit, that's a good indicator. Mm-hmm. If they have deep domain expertise mm-hmm. in that industry, that's mm-hmm. also a strong indicator. But if you're talking to somebody who's a first-time founder that has never worked in an industry, that's probably not a good indicator of the likelihood of success.
Yeah.
So I would look for either somebody that's been in industry for a long time and knows the problem really well and probably knows a lot of potential customers they can pick up the phone and call right away, or somebody that's already grown companies in the past and they know the whole process.
Yeah.
And ideally both. Mm-hmm. But if you only have one or the other, you can sometimes bring other people in that fill in those gaps.
Yeah.
But if you don't have either of those, then it's really tough.
Yeah. It's like either you've done it someone else, the whole process, or you're expert in this particular field. Otherwise, it's hard to really put everything together.
Exactly. So, you know, my advice if you're a first-time founder is to go into an industry that you already know, because I think that will give you a greater chance of success versus mm-hmm. if you're trying to go into an industry where you mm-hmm. you don't have any prior work experience.
Mm-hmm. And talk about persistence, Brad. I'm curious, mm-hmm. do you today get a lot of cold emails, cold call, cold different things from founders? If so, what's your take on those?
Sure. Usually those don't go very well because a lot of times I see that they haven't actually done any work to learn about us.
Mm.
So they pitch us
homework.
Things that are not a good fit that mm-hmm. we've already put on our website. Hey, these are the things that we're looking for. So if you're sending me a real estate deal or you're telling me about, hey, we're opening a new food franchise, that's not the type of stuff that we do. There are other people who make those kind of investments. That's just not what we do. So a lot of times I see things that are just not really the types of companies that we would ever invest in. So it's kind of a waste of time.
Yeah.
The best source, the best way to get to an investor like us is to find somebody that already knows us and that we trust and have them make an introduction.
Mm.
And, you know, LinkedIn is a great way to do that. So you can, you know, go on LinkedIn and find how you're connected to somebody, and then you can approach some of those people that are in the chain mm-hmm. and have them, you know, make the introduction. And that's someone that we're very likely to take a meeting if it's somebody that has been introduced through someone that we trust, because presumably they've already done a little bit of the research on the company and they already know what we like. And so if they're mm-hmm. referring that person to us, then it's a higher probability that it's going to be a good fit.
Yeah.
And so we're more likely to take a meeting that way
mm-hmm.
Versus just sending us an email or trying to call us and hope that, you know, there's a match.
Yeah. You want to be intentional through the right source.
Yep. And, you know, as a founder, I don't even presume that venture capital is the right way to finance the company.
Let's talk about
it. It may be.
Yeah.
it may be, like I said, if you, you know, meet those criteria that VCs typically look for, mm-hmm. you know, high growth, great unit economics, really large addressable market. Mm-hmm. But there are solid businesses that don't meet those requirements. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at things like grocery stores, for example, they have very low margins, but they have fast inventory turns. So they can be very profitable if done correctly. So my point is, I'm not saying that the only type of business worth starting is a company that's going to attract venture funding, mm-hmm. right? There are lots of other types of businesses that can meet your goals as a founder.
Yeah.
Maybe your goal is, hey, I would love to make $1 million a year, mm-hmm. Or I would love to do something that's mission-driven. Mm-hmm. I'm really passionate about a certain area, and I want to do something that helps people in a particular domain. Mm-hmm. And that's great. It may or may not fit the requirements for VCs, but it may fit the requirements for a small business loan or friends and family, or there are angel groups that provide funding as well. And so, you know, as a founder, I think you need to first start out with, you know, what gives you energy, what drives your passion, what meets your own financial needs. And maybe that's, you know, building a category defining company, or maybe it's just, you know, owning a lifestyle business that, you know, gives you the income to fund your retirement, your kids' education, and have the lifestyle that you want. And those are both fine. I'm not, you know, passing judgment on what type of business somebody wants to start.
Yeah. Thank you for the insight. Mm-hmm. And Brett, now 8 years later, you are today, you know, really passionate about supporting entrepreneurs, right, from mm-hmm. all different kinds of parts and really helping them to grow their business. I'm curious, is this everything you ever wanted? When the moment you decided to move the entire family from Boston to Austin, Texas, uh-huh. is this what you anticipate?
I think it's worked out better than I had hoped.
Yeah?
Yeah. So it's great to work with. First of all, we have a really great team at ATX that we all kind of push each other to be the best version of ourselves and to excel. And then to be working with founders every day who are trying to make a dent in the universe.
And, I love that.
Do something completely novel, and to create something from nothing is magical in its own way.
Yeah.
And so that gives me a lot of energy, having those conversations with founders and, you know, being able to support them is, you know, very gratifying.
Mm. What drives you, Brad? Why do you care?
It's very, you know, intellectually stimulating. It's very gratifying to see people, like I said, who can create something out of nothing and, mm-hmm. and create jobs and to create a new product that's going to help people in a certain industry. I think it's very gratifying. You know, we went to a conference where they had different investment managers from, you know, all different types. There was private equity and venture and hedge funds. And a lot of these people, I don't really want to be critical, but a lot of them were just talking about their strategy and saying, well, you know, we capture some arbitrage and commodity spreads or something like that. And at the end of the day, what a lot of those people are doing is making an already relatively efficient capital market a little more efficient. But is that really helping humanity? I don't know. Whereas when I look at what we're doing in venture is we're creating real jobs. You know, hundreds or thousands of jobs have been created already just directly through the investments that we've made over the last 8 years. And those jobs tend to be really well-paying. And they're bringing innovation to market that can, you know, make people's lives better. I get a lot of satisfaction and when I go to bed at night thinking that that's what we do every day versus, hey, we're just helping to make the market a little more efficient than it already is.
Yeah.
So I like the fact that, you know, we work in this, you know, innovation economy mm-hmm. and help people who are really smart, mm-hmm. who are taking chances and need to support not just capital, but also help with strategy and, mm-hmm. and introductions to customers and partners. But for us to be able to help them on their journey is really rewarding to me emotionally.
Yeah, making a dent on the universe.
Exactly.
And it takes the whole village to come together to make that happen.
Right. Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, Brad, thank you so much for that insight. That's so inspiring. What do you think success means for you? And with that definition, are you successful today?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say, you know, success is, you know, meeting the objectives that you set out to do And I would say that I'm at least part of the way there.
What's your objective?
Well, part of it was financial, you know, to take care of my family and, you know, make sure that we're provided for and our kids can get an education and all that. And I would say that that's, you know, we're definitely making strides. So that's a good thing. I don't think we've reached our full potential yet, but, you know, it's trending in the right direction. And then, you know, professionally, to be part of a firm that, you know, has been able to go on and launch 4 funds.
Incredible.
You know, as a new franchise, a lot of firms don't make it past fund 2 or fund 3.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? I don't know that.
Well, I mean, first of all, you need to develop a track record from your earlier investments. And if those early investments don't pan out well, then that can hinder your ability to raise money.
Sure.
Particularly if you, like I said, are not a spin out of an established firm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our ability to persist, you know, this long and to get to fund 4 is already saying something about our investment track record, but also just our firm's approach as a whole. We're more than just our primary fund. We actually manage more money outside of that in SPVs. So we're very heavy on allowing our investors to co-invest alongside the firm as we get further along in our investments. And then we can take our pro rata and pass it to our LPs to continue the journey later stage with the companies if they choose to. And, you know, our partner Danielle runs that part of the operation. So collectively, I think as a firm that we've shown that we have longevity, that we get along as team members, and that we're, you know, being innovative in our own asset class.
Yeah. So you are really finding the right balance between you share your gift, but in the meantime, really making a dent on this universe.
That's the goal.
Say one day, Brad, we're all long gone. What do you want people to remember you by? Or think about if you have this beautiful one word or one sentence on your gravestone. Is that the right word? What do you want that to be?
Oh, that's an amazing question. And I haven't given enough thought to that to give you a concise answer right now. But I think it would have something to do with my family and my community.
Yeah.
That I want, you know, both of those to be honored in whatever people remember me by. That I had an impact on both in a positive way. That would be my hope.
For me, I'm going to say she visited. I want to see everything. I want to have a journey. Journey in the United States, journey in China, journey all above. And I just want to say, I've been here.
Yeah, that's great. And that shows you have a real desire for knowledge and meeting people.
Yeah.
I think it'll be hard for you to cover all the places you want to go probably in one lifetime.
Well, I felt very honored. I felt almost I have a 2 lifetime already. And maybe your wife will also relate to that. I felt I have an entire life in China, but also a complete life in the United States where they are like water and oil. They are so different. But yeah, they are so also me. I'm 100% of both. So therefore, sometimes I seen the life almost through 2 lenses that I reconcile in my own mind. And it's just magical. And I felt really special and honored. And when I say I visited, because I always have the dream to see the world. And I thought the seeing the world is not necessarily just to travel, just trying the food or the culture, which is all important and relevant.
Right.
But it's my own journey of experiencing the world in that way, whether it is through startup world, corporate world, U.S., American, travel, eating spaghettis on the street, all in above is all mirage of experiences. And for me, that really drives me forward.
That's great. And, you know, China and the U.S. being so very different means it must have been quite a challenge for you to adapt and get where you are today in the U.S. So I'm sure that's why for you, those 2 chapters of your life may be so different.
They are so different. But they're different not just from it's from culture perspective, because I'm fully fluent in both languages versus maybe if you meet a lot of folks who are born in the United States, maybe they are of different ethnic background, but they are actually American. They might have a different outlook, or maybe they prefer different food. But first, for me, I'm like purely Chinese. We understand all the cultures and what's happening today. But in the meantime, I'm also loving my American dreams. Living here, being here, I felt great honored. I got a chance to be the only one woman in my family, in my village, who ever left the town to ever get to pursue a life that, you know, true to myself. Because a lot of, I know in my own generation, in my own family, it's not such a, it's not even possible for any woman to choosing a destiny of her own. So I take it for the great honor. But in the meantime, I'm just, every day I felt, it's like surreal. Like I wake up preaching myself. Is that my story? Or is that really my path or someone else? Because it seems so impossible. It's like a Mulan story we have heard of, or a Moana story. And that's, I'm very grateful every day.
That's great. Well, and you did it, which is quite an achievement, it sounds like, given how few people from your village have been able to, you know, experience anything outside of that.
Yeah, and thank you. I think until last breath on earth, we always keep going. There's always a next assignment, a growth, opportunity to serve, to create impact, to make a little dent slightly bigger in our lifetime. But thank you, Brett. Now back to you. I'm curious, Brett. What do you think is your superpower?
Ooh, good question. Well, probably analytical skills, I would say, would be where I'm strongest. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not an extrovert like you are. Definitely much more on the introverted side. And I think having an unusual background means that I'm not necessarily a deep expert in any one area, but I have the ability to look across and do pattern recognition.
You are still the archaeologist at heart, right?
Right. I mean, archaeologists, you know, look at lots of data and try to extract patterns and meaning from it.
That's exactly what you're doing today.
In a sense, yeah.
You're discovering the next greatest innovation, using the pattern recognition data analysis to create, find and support those incredible dreamers, superstars of the world, and helping them to grow and scale the impact.
Right. And so for, you know, if as you work in venture, you know, unless you're really focused on one vertical only, and we're not, we invest in several different verticals, you know, it allows you to see patterns that play out in one industry and, you know, talking to a founder in another industry and say, well, I think structurally there's a lot of similarity going on here, even though it doesn't seem on the surface like these two things are alike. Mm-hmm. And so this strategy that worked over here might serve you well in your industry as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's very powerful. You can take the best of all from one to another and really able to cross-pollinate and have them to grow.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. I'm curious, Brad, what surprised you in this whole process of shifting yourself, shifting career from, you know, one, a complete different sector to a business world and now your own venture, and now you're able to impact so many entrepreneurs from all over the world to really grow and scale. This whole journey is marvelous itself, right? Mm-hmm. What surprised you along the way?
I guess what surprised me is that I really enjoy being in the business world and I didn't.
What do you enjoy about that?
Well, when I was a kid, it just seemed boring what my parents were doing, frankly. And, you know, as I have become an adult, I can start to see and appreciate some of the things that they struggled with. And, you know, I enjoy meeting a challenge. And so, you know, this was, you know, the business world coming into it as an outsider, you know, was a challenge. And so I enjoyed, I wouldn't say overcoming it, but I would say I enjoyed the process of becoming adapted to working in the business world and, you know, the types of issues that they deal with and learning the vocabulary to be able to talk to stakeholders and, you know, help them move projects forward to a successful outcome, let's say. I didn't really understand that when I was a kid growing up. It's just, it's easy to be dismissive of your parents.
Yeah. They just do their thing.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to be the same with them.
Exactly. I'm not going to grow up like them. I thought. And so I kind of went the completely opposite direction, but ended up kind of the arc of my career ended up bending back towards the direction that they had gone in.
Yeah.
And, I don't regret that.
Yeah.
Even though I really enjoyed what I was doing, I don't have any regrets about my, early career choices either.
But if you do it again, would you change anything else? Anything, Brad?
That is a good question, because even though I really enjoyed archaeology, was it worth 10 years of my time if it wasn't what I ended up becoming professionally? So that's the real question is, where would I be if I had started my journey 10 years earlier, where I am today? Is that worth getting a head start on it? Is that worth missing out on the experiences that I had? And that's not an easy question to answer.
I completely understand. Thank you for the honesty.
Yeah.
Did you surprise yourself along the way? Because at the end of the day, it's never just about a project, a company. It's who we're becoming along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Did you surprise yourself of who you are becoming today, Brad? I'm curious.
That's a good question. I would say yes, in the sense that I didn't know that I would adapt to being a software developer or being an investor. But I have, done both of those things, and I've been in them long enough that I feel like, okay, I know what I'm doing now. I've been at it long enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I surprised myself at how well I would adapt to both of those environments.
Yeah.
But,
extraordinarily well.
I mean, I hope so, but I certainly have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And continue to enjoy it. And I guess I assumed when I was a youngster that, I would get bored with being in the business world and wouldn't want to stick with it. And that's why I decided not to pursue that, even though both of my parents kind of encouraged me and nudged me in those directions. But I think what helps is that as an investor, I get to talk to a lot of different people doing all kinds of different projects.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's very stimulating. I think if I were focused on just one thing and doing that day in and day out, that it probably would, get boring, or I would get burned out after a few years of doing that. But, the novelty of being able to work with new founders constantly and new ideas that they're, trying to build products around, that novelty is really stimulating to me and probably helps me, stay engaged in what I'm doing. And I don't think I'll ever get bored of it because there's always something new.
Yeah. It's truly, you're like the archaeologist at heart. You still find the next best artifact that the world have not yet seen. You are focused on different variety of sector. You move from one project to another.
Mm-hmm.
You meet these incredible smart people to find out, do they actually solving the real problem and really helping them to create a dent on this universe. You are still doing exactly what you meant to do, Brad.
Maybe so. That's a great way to phrase it. So I thrive on that.
I can tell. I can see the excitement when you discover that artifact in this beautiful ground. And similarly, when you meet an amazing team in your next conversation, I imagine a spark on your eyes is equally bright, if not brighter, right?
Yeah. Well, there's always a process of discovery.
That's what made life so exciting.
Yeah, I agree.
So what is next for you, Brad? Now you have come a long journey, you have find your path, and you love what you do, you're contributing to this universe, the light, the joy, all in above. What is next for you?
That is a good question. I think in the short term, more of the same. I mean, like I said, what I do every day, it's varied. And so that provides a lot of the novelty that I need and the discovery that I need in order to stay engaged. And I could, honestly, I think I could keep doing this for a long time. Whether I will or not is another matter, but I don't have any sort of immediate plans to transition into anything else.
Yeah. You love what you do.
Yeah. So, I'm always open to something new, but don't really feel any urgency or desire right now to explore that. I have plenty on my plate. plenty of new things to explore every day, just in the founders that we support and new founders that I talk to on a daily basis. So that's, for me, there's plenty of excitement in that.
That's beautiful. Sounds like you find your peace.
Yeah.
And for our listeners who may be not so familiar with the role of an investor, I'm curious, Brad, can you describe a typical day for our listeners? What will be the investor typical day? I know you and varies from you and your colleagues because your different role and responsibilities such.
Yeah.
But can you describe that?
Sure. I mean, some days are just back-to-back meetings. You know, for example, I serve on the boards of a number of companies, and you know, every quarter there's typically a board meeting, and so there'll be usually a week where a lot of these meetings are occurring, and so. And some of the meetings are kind of 2 to 4 hours each for the board meetings. And also you want to do prep work ahead of that. So they'll usually send you a packet with some information about the company's performance that quarter. And you want to be able to go through all that and have some questions in mind when you actually get to the board meeting. So some weeks, that's 80% of my time.
Oh, wow.
Is preparing for board meetings or actually sitting in board meetings. Other weeks, we don't have any board meetings going on. We're taking pitches. So we'll be meeting with founders in coffee shops or having them come to our office and, show us their deck and, walk through it and talk about their startup and how it's performing and where it could go, what the potential is and, what the current round is that they're raising. And so some weeks are very heavy on that. Some weeks are heavy with just more informal engagement with our existing portfolio companies. Mm-hmm. So it's between board meetings, but we're having calls because either A, they just want to check in and talk to us about how things are going, between board meetings, because that's a whole quarter. And sometimes if you check in on every month or twice a quarter, you can kind of nip problems in the bud before they really blow up into something big.
Yeah.
Or there's something urgent going on. They got an acquisition offer or they're trying to hire a key position and they want to talk about it with the board or, maybe one of the founders is transitioning out of the company and we need to come up with a plan for bringing in a new founder or, promoting somebody who's already been there to kind of backfill the role of the founder that may be transitioning out for whatever reason. So there's always something going on. We have, I would say, kind of 35 to 40 active companies right now.
Wow. That
we have investments in.
That's a lot of fire.
And we have,
out.
We have, three people on our investment team. So it keeps us pretty busy just with the existing portfolio, plus, all of the new companies that are constantly in conversation with us. So there's no shortage of things to do.
Totally. How do you keep level head when there are so many things going on? Because I imagine when you get a call, usually it's bad news. That's probably good news too. But usually, something happened, acquisition, founder maybe resign and such. Right? How do you keep a level head facing those challenges with a calm and peace manner?
Well, the good thing is we have a great team. So we divide and conquer.
Yeah.
And so I don't have to worry about all 40 companies. So I have, a subset of companies that I tend to focus more of my attention on. And so between the three of us, we tend to cover, our existing portfolio pretty well. And also it helps that some of the companies have graduated kind of beyond the seed and Series A zone where we tend to focus our time.
Yeah.
If they're a Series B or C company now,
they do their thing.
They have, later investors that have, joined the board. We may not even be on the board at that point. So that helps us to manage our bandwidth. So, we have our season in the sun and then we pass the baton to a later stage investor who's going to lead the charge from there because that's their level of expertise. They know how to scale a company from 10 million to 50 million in revenue. And we're more in that first 10 million.
Yeah.
That's where we focus our efforts.
What do you think is the key to success for that first $10 million?
I think it has to do with identifying who is the best customer that has a real problem that you can solve and then getting the right product, getting that product market fit is really what that first 10 million in revenue tends to be about is, getting real product market fit and then figuring out how to aggregate those customers and scale the organization to serve a larger number of them. But, early on, it's about finding the right person because I think a lot of entrepreneurs get into startups because they want to please people. And, they're trying to solve a problem, but not everybody is the right customer. And learning how to say no is a really important skill to say, like, you're the right customer. I'm going to work with you. You're the wrong customer. I'm going to refer you to somebody else who's better equipped to serve your needs.
So would you recommend then to narrow down versus zoom out? Because initially, I imagine most funders would like to say, well, everybody in the world is our customer versus we focus on, well, this demographic in this particular bucket are our target customers.
Right. Well, when you're serving the right customer, you find customers that are less price sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tend to buy faster. So your sales cycle compresses
mm-hmm.
and your margins tend to be better because you can typically charge a higher price versus when you're trying to serve a wider range of customers, people that are not a good fit are going to be slow to adopt and they're going to be much more price sensitive because they have other options.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I advise founders to really focus in on their ideal customer profile and help to define that. And sometimes it takes a little bit of a few iterations to really learn who your ideal customer is. Initially, you may have a hypothesis, you go to market, you start talking to people and you find out that's not really where the problem lies. So you start talking to some other customers. And so it's not unusual at kind of the seed round to find companies that are struggling to find the right customer. But once you do,
mm-hmm.
then you really need to be maniacally focused on serving them.
I love that. But how do you balance that, Brad, with mm-hmm. the zooming in that, you know, specific set of customer versus you talk about the top line, you want to make sure the market is, you know, at least billions, right?
Yeah.
How do you balance that?
So as an investor, we want to see that their ideal customer represents a really large market.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
So it's not that you create a really large market just by having a broad set of customers. You need a very targeted set of customers, but that there's a bunch of them who would be ready to buy when you get around to serving them,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's a billion or $2 billion market that might be a large enough market that, you know, an institutional investor like us would be interested in backing a founder who's got a product for that specific, you know, segment of the market.
So so we want to make sure that specific small segment of market representing a billions.
Right.
Not them plus others billions.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can always aggregate to as many billions as you want to. The question is, how many different types of customers would you have to serve to do that?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
And how would you be able to have a product that meets all of those different needs and be able to acquire those customers in a cost-efficient way? That's why focusing on your ideal customer is so important, because it helps you to use your limited resources to their best effect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you for that. I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs maybe fall into a illusion of the bigger the market, the better it is versus actually having the right balance. So thank you mm-hmm. for articulating that.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that there's day that, Brad, you will stand, you know, all day or all week listening to pitches, right? And I know different people have different style when it comes to pitches. What do you listen to? Of course, given it's your first time meeting with her or him, you don't really yet get a chance to really do the research. You're not yet dive into the problem, talk to customer just yet. And the initial conversation and meetings, what are you looking or evaluate when you meet those founders?
So I always want to start with who's the customer and what's the problem that we're solving here?
Mm-hmm.
And then how big is that market?
Mm-hmm.
And how well does your product actually meet the needs of the target market that you've identified? So I always want to start with the customer. Mm-hmm. I don't want to start with, okay, we're raising money and these are the terms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's,
no one cares unless we know, right?
Exactly. So that's the order of operations, is start with the problem and who the customer is. And then eventually we'll get to the terms. Okay, if the terms make sense, that's great. But it doesn't matter if it's not a problem worth solving.
Yeah, yeah.
So we always start with that.
Yeah.
And a lot of entrepreneurs, when they're talking to me about the size of their market, they don't really understand what total addressable market means.
Mm, tell us that.
So a lot of times I'll see, for example, let's say someone is trying to pitch me a deal on travel software, like corporate travel software.
Okay.
They'll say something like, travel is a $1 trillion market.
But that's not corporate travel.
Exactly. That's total category spend.
Yeah.
What I'm interested in is, okay, how many people are actually spending money on corporate travel software?
Yeah.
That's the market. For me, that's the total addressable market.
Yeah.
And then we can narrow it down from there. But if you start with total category spend, it either tells me that you're trying to tell me there's a bigger market than there really is, or you don't know what your addressable market actually is.
And for folks maybe just new to this space, how do you really do that research? This is a little bit, you know, because these days, right, they have not yet have the product market. It's not that easy to find the right number. What would you advise her or him think about that market sizing slide?
Yeah. So there are market research firms like IDC and Gartner and Forrester and a bunch of others that cover different industries and can provide you with a lot of that information.
But so, all these days, they might not have the fund to engage.
Well, you can find some of this information for free, or in some cases, the reports, you know, may only cost you a few hundred or a few thousand dollars. And frankly, I think it's a very good investment if you're going to invest so much of your time and energy into something. Wouldn't you like to know that it's a worthwhile problem to solve? So I would not skip that step if I'm a founder. I would want to know ahead of time, how big is the market that I'm trying to get into? Is it worth my time? Because I might be spending, you know, 80 hours a week for the next 5 years trying to tackle this problem. And if it turns out that there's only a very small market, I would have liked to have known that at the beginning before I invested all of that energy.
Great point.
Yeah.
Okay. So engage with a professional firm, figure out numbers. Anything else you want to share on that slide? Do you care about bottom up? That's a top down, right? Do you care about bottom up?
Sure. I mean, I like it both ways. You know, kind of a top down analysis and bottom up. You know, frankly, either could work. It depends on where you're getting your data. And is that you know, credible? Is it reputable? You want to know that these numbers weren't just made up, for example. But you know, it's not just important in the total market. It's also, there's TAM, SAM, and SOM. So TAM is total addressable market. For me, that's worldwide. And for most startups, that's not relevant at the beginning, certainly.
Like,
you're not going to launch a software product and conquer the world day one, right? So, you know, after TAM, you've got serviceable addressable market. That's the typically the geography that you're able to service initially. And so for most founders here, that's going to be the US market as the initial target. And then SOM is the serviceable obtainable market. That's saying, okay, given substitutes and competition within the market that we can serve, what percentage of the market do we think we can realistically capture? And then what does that look like? So really, when I look at a deck or if I'm looking at a financial model, it's really the assumptions that I'm mostly interested in. What assumptions is the team using?
What's the right assumption? Because I saw founders put 10% all the time. Like, I'll just acquire 1%, what 10% of market, boom, we'll be so successful.
Right.
How does that percentage do you looking at?
That's a good question. I guess as an investor, you want to say, can I believe, is this plausible? But then you want to understand, okay, you say that you're going to get 10% of the market, and that's baked into your numbers.
Assumption.
But how do you actually, what's your go-to-market that's going to achieve that?
All that to tie together.
Yeah. So you want to understand the assumptions and then tie that back to what's the operating plan that you're going to follow that's going to lead to this outcome. And then can I believe that? Do I think that your team has the skill set and the drive and the energy to actually accomplish that in the face of, you know, existing competitors or substitutes that you can't discount? Because sometimes founders don't really, they have blinders on. They're like, okay, as soon as I get this widget in the market, everybody's going to love it. Everybody's going to buy it. And that basically never happens. So you want to be cognizant of the existing competitors that are out there and the existing substitutes that people have relied on, like, how has this problem been solved to date? You know, obviously this problem's not new, it's been around. So what have people been doing up until now before you launched your widget? and so, you know, being aware of that and the resistance that may create. And how are you going to overcome that? Those are all interesting questions. So usually that's where we spend a lot of our time is, okay, you've convinced me that there's a real market. You convinced me this is a real problem. But now, how are you actually going to make people aware of it? How are you going to differentiate your product in a way that matters to your customers and that's going to drive people to adopt the solution that you're bringing to them? And that's where a lot of the interesting conversation happens.
Wow, Brad. I'm just truly inspired, not only by your journey, but by you. You have such a humble but grounded research mind when you look into those problems, looking at those superstars, and you still have that archaeologist in heart, not only finding the right or next exciting superstars, but really using a really thoughtful way to examine and also supporting them on the path of growing and scaling. So it's a lot of excitement, but right back with the number, back with the data. And I believe that is your superpower. And therefore, founders today are truly just, you know, so lucky and grateful to be part of you and affirmed to on the path of growing, scaling.
Thanks. Well, you know, we look at an investment in an early stage company as almost like a marriage, because it's probably going to be kind of a 5 to 7 year journey together. And we're partners. And frankly, the only way for us to get out of the investment is for you, the founder, to be successful.
Oh, I like that.
And this is not like a publicly traded stock where we can buy shares of the stock, and then if we change our mind later, we can just sell out and get out of that position. Once we're in business together,
you're in.
We're in for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have, you know, every incentive to want you to be successful and to be collaborative and supportive along the way.
Is your last advice you want to share with advice for the entrepreneurs? You know, since we are he or she listened the entire journey, now they were like, wow, I'm ready. We're ready to, you know, make the Dallas universe. Is there one last thought you want to share with them?
Sure. I would say, you know, there's a huge opportunity cost to being an entrepreneur. A lot of entrepreneurs make less than they would have if they had stayed at their corporate jobs.
For sure.
So, you know, if you think about it, it's like having one silver bullet in your pistol and you want to make it count. So, you know, I don't want to discourage anybody from making that leap, because I think it's an amazing thing. But I just want people to be very intentional about, you know, making sure that it's a problem that they are well equipped to deal with, and to not waste that opportunity on something that's not going to be a good fit for their skills and also their passions. So
thank you for the advice, because I think today the entrepreneurship sounds like a shiny object. Like, oh, I'm the founder. We are all founders. Sounds so exciting and glamorous. Yet we all know outside from that glamorous, you know, turn and the title and all, the grind is real. The challenge is real. Those dark moments are truly real. And, you know, exactly like you said, being that intentionality of knowing exactly not only your skill set, what you're passionate about, but more importantly, what problem you're really solving, and how you're supporting that set of customers are really vital for anyone's success when it comes to entrepreneurship.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Brad, for being here and share the thoughtful journey with each and every one of us. I am so enjoy that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it was a real pleasure being here.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. What an honor. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I do. And I cannot wait to see you all next week. Bye, guys.